4 years prior to the death of Pope Urban II, His Holiness delivered a sermon that would transform the history of Europe. It was a brisk autumn morning in the year 1095 when crowds gathered around him in the small French town of Clermont. Each individual transfixed on every ounce in word he spoke. The months that followed, his message was echoed across the Western world. The Pope proclaimed a new holy war against Islam for ownership and control of the most hallowed site in the Christian world, the sacred city of Jerusalem. Urban's call to arms initiated a struggle that would rage for more than two centuries, one that fires the imagination and fuels debate even to this day. The story of the Crusade today is remembered as unspeakable violence of medieval knights and jihadi warriors, of castles and kingdoms, crooked kings, heroism, betrayal and sacrifice. From the summer of 1096, and an estimated 100,000 Christians set out to walk an estimated 2,500 miles across the face of the known world toward the holy city of Jerusalem. Not since the distant glories of the ancient Greco-Roman era had a mighty force of this size assembled. Every age and class of citizen, peasant or of nobility, made up the first group of crusaders. Christian soldiers who endured unspeakable suffering during an armed pilgrimage went on for 3 long years. The Age of Crusades had begun, and this is our story. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 29, The True Story of the First Crusade. Now before we begin, sorry for missing last week's episode. I was down with the flu, my nose was all sniffled, my voice was broken, I didn't want to risk doing an episode and sounding like death itself, so I skipped a week. Do apologise, let's get back to it, and let's try and jump in as fast as we can, since this episode is going to be a long one. Now, last time we began the first part of our special, The People's Crusade, the rather less known story of the First Crusade. A story's conclusion that nearly derailed the entire First Crusade before it even properly began. After the false start of its undisciplined first wave, the First Crusade had begun in earnest, and this time its march would not be stopped until it had reached the goal, the Holy City of Jerusalem, in July 1099 AD. Now, rather than dwindle on anything out of podcast related this week, as I said, I want us to get straight back into the action this episode. I want us to tell a story of the actual First Crusade from start to finish. So, with that in mind, and with this episode most likely being a long one, let's get started. We head back to Europe, where the princes of Europe are gathering to march on the Holy Land, with an army of holy knights, with an actual plan, which is different from the pilgrims that Peter the Hermit led in the past episode. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's deus vault ourselves back to medieval Europe. The concept of the Crusade was unleashed amid a spiritual age. It was an era in many ways that were wholly alien to our own. Today, many may be acculturated to notions of tolerance, scepticism, and religious diversity. However, a singular truth bound together almost every human being living in the 11th century Europe, unconditional and complete belief in Christianity. The Church taught that every human would face a moment of genuine judgment. Those to be found in purity would receive the reward of the promised eternal paradise in heaven, forever in blissful servitude dwelling in the kingdom of God. If you are found to be a sinner, then you face certain punishment of a fiery hell, forever bound in slavery to the evil self-appointed god Satan. Agony and ecstasy was the whole idea of medieval Christianity. Primed to seek redemption, Western Christians were enthralled when Urban II announced his expedition to the Holy Land. However, there would be an enormous price. The faithful would have to give up everything to participate in a terrifying, near-suicidal journey to the Middle East. In return, the Pope promised a guarantee of eternal salvation. Tens of thousands of lower to middle class Christians responded to the Pope's brilliantly conceived campaign. However, Urban's target audience would be the princes of Western Europe, the kings, the rulers, the lords. They were a violent warrior class fighting for survival in the world of savage lawlessness. Hence, warlords would naturally become crusader leaders. Christian knights, for whom the Pope's call solved in very particular dilemmas, would also come. The Pope knew well the anxiety of Christian warriors trapped in a worldly profession permutated with violence. Even though taught by the church that bloodshed was sinful, the real genius of Urban's crusading idea is that this solved the unique dilemma that reconciled faith and violence. Urban spoke of a new sacred struggle in which fighting would not simply be permitted, but actively encouraged and even rewarded. The day following Pope Urban's sermon in Clermont, Count Raymond of Toulouse, the most powerful secular lord in southern France, became the first nobleman to commit to the crusade. Determined to prepare his soul for the expedition ahead, Raymond then came to the cathedral in Le Puy. The count made a sizable donation to ensure the favourable intercession of the Virgin Mary. According to a chronicler, he requested, "So long as I live, candles should burn for me incessantly day and night upon the altar before the revered image of the Mother God." Raymond was also the oldest, at age 55, and perhaps the best known of the Crusader nobles. Because of his age and fame, Raymond expected to be the leader of the entire First Crusade. For the nobleman and knightly class, the crusade offered the reward of eternal salvation. In return, their personal fortunes would bankroll the holy expedition east. Even though Count Raymond was a crusade's eldest statesman, he was just one of many of the rich and powerful noblemen for whom the combined military conquest and religious redemption proved irresistible. These contemporaries came from Germany, Italy, France, Belgium, England, and Scotland, all to join the adventure to the east. Many wrote remarkable letters detailing the difficult and violent journey to the Holy Land. One of the most popular manuscripts of the Crusaders was that of William of Tyre. The oldest surviving illustrated copy was produced in 1289. It is the most famous chronicle of the Crusades. William of Tyre was a Christian historian who worked in the Holy Land during the 12th century. The colourful manuscript depicts many of the famous episodes of the Christian exploits in the East, including the first moment that the first Crusaders set out from Europe. For most people, embarking on the first Crusade was a mammoth leap of faith. This would be a journey to an unknown world, attempted with no planning, no reasonable navigation, and no maps. The main contingents of knights soon followed. It was only in the first months of 1097, almost a year after the first pilgrims set out, that finally the First Crusade united at Constantinople, which was the capital of the Byzantine Empire. For most crusaders, this place was the end of the world as they knew it, a large metropolis 10 times the size of any city in Western Europe. It was the centre of the Greek Church in the East, which was the greatest Christian superpower of the medieval age, and it was also the home the Eastern Roman Empire, that old distant relic from antiquity. The capital city boasted an unrivalled collection of sacred relics, the crown of thorns, locks of hair from the Virgin Mary, the head of John the Baptist, and the remains of the apostates. Constantinople also had the most spectacular church, the Hagia Sophia. Another man of nobility who eventually joined the Crusaders in Constantinople was Boemond I of Antioch. He was baptised Mark, possibly because he was born at his father's castle at San Marco Argentano in Calabria, but he was nicknamed Boemond after a legendary giant. In 1097, Boemond and his uncle Roger I of Sicily were attacking Amlof, which had revolted against Duke Roger, when bands of crusaders began to pass on their way through Italy to Constantinople. Apparently, Boemond had religious reasons for joining the First Crusade, in addition to his love for violence. While he was well known as a warrior, Boemond's leadership in Italy was small, which may have been another motive for joining the crusade. Another great man was Count Stephen of Blois. the son-in-law of William the Conqueror. He arrived in Constantinople in the summer of 1097. In a letter to his wife, he wrote, "I arrived in Constantinople with great joy by the grace of God. The emperor received me with dignity and honour, and with the greatest affection as if it was his own son." Another army had came to the capital as well, that of Robert Curtos, Duke of Normandy. Robert was the eldest son of William the Conqueror and brother to William Rufus, King of England. Remember, our King Duncan II of Scotland had served under Robert during his early years and was raised as a Norman knight, as we told in a previous episode. Duncan II then left with an army and his siblings to take back the throne of Scotland. Remember, he did succeed, but in doing so he got overthrown again by his uncle Donald eventually. Robert Curtos was reportedly so poor that he often had to stay in bed for lack of clothes. In order to raise money for the crusade, he mortgaged his duchy to his brother William II of England. His army, during the contingent of Robert II, Count of Flanders, and Stephen, the Count of Blois. The crusaders have arrived at the gateway to the Orient and the frontier of Islam. The Byzantine Emperor had been for a while appealing to the West for help in defending Christendom's eastern borders. With the aid of his troops, the crusaders targeted Nicaea. Nicaea was located on the eastern shore of the Lake Askia. It had been captured from the Byzantine Empire by the Seljuk Turks in 1081 and formed the capital of the Sultanate of Rum. The siege of Nicaea happened in the mid-1097s AD as the crusaders began to leave Constantinople. Godfrey of Blois was the first to arrive at Nicaea, with Beaumont of Taranto, Boimund's nephew Tancred, Raymond of Toulouse, Robert II of Flanders, and Stephen of Blois and Robert Curtos followed later on. Also, Peter the Hermit and some of the survivors of the People's Crusade, which we told in the last episode, and a small Byzantine force joined later during the siege. They arrived on May the 6th with very little food. Taking notice, Boimund arranged for food to be brought by land and by sea as he had the means to do so. They began their attacks on the 14th of May, assigning their forces to different sections of the walls, which was well built with 200 towers. Boimund captured on the north side of the city, Godfrey on the south, and Raymond on the eastern gate. The siege lasted for 1 month and was eventually conquered by the crusaders. The crusaders fled Nicaea on June the 26th in two contingents. The weaker force by Boimund, Tancred, Robert of Flanders, Godfrey, Baldwin, Stephen, and Hugh in the rear. Spirits were high, and Stephen wrote to his wife that they expected to be in Jerusalem within 5 weeks. However, he was gravely mistaken. They wouldn't reach Jerusalem for another 2 years. This attack was on the official launch of the Holy War. There wasn't an immediate response to the audacious invasion. The Christians had inadvertently chosen the perfect moment to strike. The Muslim world was in a state of disarray, splintered by religious and ethnic divisions. As yet, Islam could not draw upon the same profound sense of shared purpose that unified the Crusaders, the dream that drove these Christians towards their sacred objective. Because of its vast size, the Crusade couldn't logistically move as a single force. A column of more than 60,000 people might take an entire day just to pass a single point. Gathering food and supplies along the way like a plague of locusts would have slowed the travel down tremendously. Instead, they decided to travel in groups. 100 miles east of Nicaea, the first group found an abandoned Byzantine military camp and would wait for the others. However, the whole army did not reach the camp. As the crusaders marched across the plains of Asia Minor, they were ambushed by a ferocious band of nomadic warriors, the first terrifying taste of Turkish horsemen in full flight. The Turks were howling like wolves. They began shooting a cloud of arrows. We were all stunned by this because for all of us, this form of warfare was unknown. Huddled together like sheep in a fold, we were trembling and frightened, surrounded on all sides by enemies so that we couldn't turn in any direction. That was from an anonymous Christian crusader. Pigeonholed against a seemingly endless multitude of Turks, the Christians were thrown into chaos. Instead of retreat like the People's Crusade, the leader managed to establish an offensive formation. But isolated and exposed, the Crusaders faced disaster. The Turks killed men, women, and children, sparing no one on the grounds of age. Shocked and terrified by this attack, girls who were nobly born rushed to get themselves dressed up and offered themselves to the Turks so that, at least appeased by their beauty, they may offer the captives pity. The Crusaders were absolutely terrified by what they encountered. They'd come across an alien enemy, something they'd never encountered before. However, something extraordinary occurred. They did not give up. Godfrey arrived with a force of 50 knights, fighting through the Turkish battle lines to reinforce Boymund. Though the day small groups of reinforcements from Raymond and Hugh as well as Godfrey arrived, some killed by the Turks, others fighting to reach Boymund's camp, as the Crusaders' losses mounted, the Turks became more aggressive, and the Crusader army found itself from the marshy banks of the river into the shallows. But the Crusaders held on, and after approximately 7 hours of battle, Raymond's knights arrived. It is unclear if Raymond was with them, or if they arrived ahead of Raymond, launching a vicious surprise attack across the Turkish flank, but it turned back the enemy in disharmony and allowed the Crusaders to reassemble. The Crusaders did indeed become rich, at least for a short time, after capturing the treasury of the Turks. The Turks fled, and Arslan the ruler to the other concerns in his eastern territory. Arslan punitively took the male Greek children from the region extending from the area where the battle took place, sending many as slaves to Persia. On the other hand, the Crusaders were allowed to march virtually unopposed through Anatolia on the way to Antioch. It took almost 3 months to cross Anatolia in the heat of summer, and in October they began the siege of Antioch. Strengthened by their faith, the Western invaders seemed to reach invincibility. In contrast, Islam's defence lay in the hands of squabbling warlords, but the Crusaders faced a different kind of enemy as he marched across Asia Minor. Enduring the blistering heat of the summer months, plagued by starvation and thirst, for the first time a shortage of water became a real issue. And worst, almost all of the Crusaders' Western horses died by the time they reached the Holy Land. Many were forced to ride on donkeys or oxen. The idea of a grand Christian military force is in reality an illusion. Christian numbers were severely depleted by an epic journey that concluded with a terrifying traverse of the Tarius Mountains. By the time the first Crusaders reached northern Syria in the fall of 1097, only around half of those who left Europe survived. The crossing of Asia Minor had been an extraordinary feat in itself. Standing at the gateway to the Holy Land, the Crusaders faced a colossal task that eclipsed everything that had come before. They were facing the conquest of one of the great cities of the Orient, Antioch. This was a crucial staging post. As the Crusade now looked south to Jerusalem itself, perhaps less than a month's march away. However, Antioch was under the rulership of Muslim Turks, shielded by two great mountains and a ring of awesome battlements that made it one of the greatest fortified cities in the medieval world. The landscape surrounding the city made it virtually impossible for a surprise attack to take place. The city was garrisoned by about 5,000 Turks, enough for a defensive team. However, not sufficient enough to confront the Crusaders in an open battle. The result? An appalling stalemate that would test the faith of the Christians beyond any bounds. From the autumn of 1097, the Crusaders committed themselves to the grinding reality of a medieval encirclement siege, a war of attrition that would go on for 8 months. That coming winter would prove to be a living hell for the Crusaders camped outside Antioch, facing illness, disease, and starvation. The pinnacle of the Crusaders' suffering came in January 1098. Thousands lost their lives from malnourishment and starvation. Food was so scarce that some resorted to eating their rodents for sustenance. Naturally, many questioned why God had abandoned them on this holy pilgrimage. Just when it seemed that things could not take a worm for the worse, the Muslim world finally appeared to unite. Just as the advent of spring began to shift the balance of the siege in the Crusaders' favour, a treacherous rumour began to circulate. Scouts from the Christian encampment reported that they had seen a Muslim army swarming over mountain passes like the sands of the sea. Some 40,000 Syrian and Mesopotamian troops were on the way, and all of this they were less than 1 week away from Antioch. The Crusaders were outnumbered 2-1. Stranded outside the city, the Christian army would surely be crushed against Antioch's walls. Facing the very real threat of panic and mass desertion, the Crusader leaders convened an emergency council. Boymond, the clever military leader who had taken charge during the battle previously, came forward. Boymond argued that whoever could orchestrate Antioch's fall should be given legal rights to the city. After the bargain was negotiated and sealed, the shrewd Boymond showed his hand. The ruthless and cunning leader had made contact with an Armenian Christian renegade inside the city of Antioch. This person was well-to-do, an Armenian Christian convert to Islam, and he was an armor maker who had held a high post in the Seljuk Turkish government during the Crusades. He was more than willing to betray the city and to work as a spy for Boymond. Boymond was offered riches and safety guarantees in return for his assistance. This man was disgruntled with his position in the government. He had been recently fined, and even worse, his wife had been seduced by a senior Turkish officer. Just a few days after the emergency council, a small group of Boymond's soldiers made their way to an isolated section of the city's eastern walls. June the 3rd, 1098, deserter inside the walls, unsatisfied with his commanding officer, hung a rope ladder for Boyman's men, who subsequently climbed up into the city and opened its gates. They were able to dispatch the guard in each of the surrounding towers, and then a small gate was opened below. The calm and silent air of the night was suddenly shattered as burglars sounded the signal of a wave of attacks on all parts of the city. The Christians screamed out their battle cry, "God wills it! God wills it! Deus vult!" The Muslim garrison was thrown into utter confusion. Soon, Antioch's remaining gates were thrown open and the Crusaders poured in. In the half-light of dawn, the chaotic slaughter began. The intruder who had helped the Crusaders get into the city, the local Armenians, also joined in the massacring of the Turks. The Christians, fueled by 8 months of bottled anger and aggression. However, the next morning the Crusaders were trapped inside Antioch. The besiegers had become the besieged, as an army surrounded them. The Christians were trapped inside a city with depleting supplies and faced the greatest test of their faith. Very quickly, food ran short and starvation became endemic. The poor were forced to eat the leather of their own shoes and forced to drink the blood of the few remaining horses to sustain themselves. Many Crusaders scaled the walls and escaped during the cover of nightfall. These included many well-known knights. They also were going to have another enemy to face. The Crusaders reached their lowest point. Ridden with sickness, plagued with hunger, and terrified of the army outside the city, it seemed that the end of the Crusade was about to end in defeat. Would a divine miracle save them? The citadel inside the city was being held by the Turks as well, so they really were surrounded. But in mid-June 1098, a southern French peasant named Peter Bartholomew came forward announcing that he had experienced a series of visions. In these, Saint Andrew had revealed a resting place of the Holy Lance, the spear that had lanced the side of Christ on the tortured stake. Peter led a group of Christians to a basilica in Antioch and began digging. One member of the party described the scene. "We had begun digging until the evening when some of us began to give up hope of unearthing the lance. But Peter, seeing the exhaustion of the workers, stripped his outer garments and clad only in a shirt and barefooted, dropped into the hole. He then begged us to pray to God to return his lance and give us strength and victory to his people. Finally, the Lord showed us his lance, and I kissed its tip as it barely protruded from the ground. What a great joy and exultation filled the great city." In reality, all he probably found was a small shard of metal. But the idea that God might manifest his will on earth through a sacred object, part and parcel of the medieval Christianity and ravings of religious fanatic, coupled with discovery of such a significant relic, had the potential to rejuvenate the Crusaders' belief in the holy mission. Most accounts indicate that the discovery of the Holy Lance had an electrifying effect on the Crusaders' state of mind. Even though they were exhausted, starving, and facing different and difficult odds, this seemingly irrefutable demonstration of divine support fired the Christians to take up arms and confront the Turks head-on. The Turks' mighty army was actually made up of levies from Baghdad, Persia, Palestine and Damascus, and the internal quarrels amongst the emirs took precedence over any unity against the Franks. The only thing that united his allies was a common fear of the Turkish leader's real goal, which was the conquest of all of their lands. If Antioch fell to him, he would be invincible. However, the Christians scored a miraculous victory. On the 28th of June, when Bohemond, the leader of the Christian army, decided to attack, the emirs decided to humble the leader by abandoning him at the critical moment. The leader of the Turks was taken by surprise by the organization and discipline of the Christian army. This motivated, unified Christian army was in fact so large that the leader's strategy of dividing his own forces was ineffective. He was quickly routed by the Crusaders. He was forced to retreat and return to Mosul, a broken man. Antioch was theirs. It was the cult of the Holy Lance was born, a cult that had the power to shape the future of the Crusade. It's long been believed that the discovery of the Holy Lance provided an electrifying boost to the Crusader morale, sending the Christians spiriting out of Antioch to confront the leader of the Turks and his mighty army. Today there exists a surviving copy of the Chronicles written by the Armenian historian Matthew of Edessa, who lived during the time of the First Crusade. Poised between the Christian and Muslim perspective, Matthew's account offers a more neutral version of the events, and it suggests a surprisingly new interpretation of the story. In a unique passage, Matthew describes in detail what actually happened in Antioch, June 1098. The Franks became threatened with a famine because provisions in the city had long become exhausted. More and more hard-pressed, they resolved to obtain from the Turkish leader a promise of amnesty on condition they delivered the city into his hands and returned to their own country. This passage is astonishing. This reveals that far from sprinting out of Antioch to confront their enemy, the Crusaders were ready to give in and go home. For so long, the Crusaders' reaction to the discovery of the Holy Lance has been held up as a proof of their blind piety. According to the account of Matthew of Edessa, the Turkish leader dismissed the terms of the Crusaders, leaving the Christians with a hopeless choice to die within the city of starvation or die fighting. In the end, the Crusaders finally made an extraordinary decision to confront the Turkish force head on, but they seem to have done so not in a state of ecstatic religious fervour, but in utter desperation, expecting to die. The Christians fought with primal desperation, ironically facing certain death with nothing to lose, so they won, defeating an enemy that turned out to be anything but invincible. Far from being a united army, the Turkish leader's force was actually a loose and fragile coalition of rival warlords, each suspicious that the Turkish leader himself was hoping to use the Crusader invasion as a pretext to seize Antioch as his own. That's why the Muslim army shattered so readily when struck by the Christian charge. In the months that followed, some of the Crusaders' leaders became increasingly greedy for power and plunder. Bohemond remained to rule Antioch, and instead of driving on to Jerusalem, the expedition's holy goal, Raymond insisted on pursuing further conquests in Syria and Lebanon. For many Christians, these delays were unforgivable. And some even began to question the story of the Holy Lance and the integrity of the increasingly delusional fanatic who had found it. Facing a barrage of criticism, Peter actually begged to undergo a potentially lethal trial by ordeal to prove his innocence and the Holy Lance's authenticity. A trial by ordeal was an ancient judicial practice by which the guilt or innocence of the accused was determined by subjecting them to a painful, or at least an unpleasant, usually dangerous experience. On the 10th of April 1099, outside the city of Arica in Lebanon, preparation for a dramatic trial began, the outcome of which would determine the fate of the First Crusade. Peter spent the next 4 days fasting to purify his soul, and on Good Friday, olive branches were stacked into two pyres, 4 feet tall and 13 feet in length. With the two pyres set on fire, wearing a tunic and bearing the relic of the Holy Lance, Peter walked into the centre of the raging inferno. Some of his supporters later wrote that he emerged from the flames unscathed, and later that a crowd mobbed him and broke the bones of his body. On the contrary, the opponents wrote that he was fatally wounded by the burns. One thing remains true: the man who found the Holy Lance at Antioch died within the 12 days of this ordeal. The spell of the Holy Lance was shattered. With it went the reputation of Raymond of Toulouse. It was Godfrey of Blois who emerged as the Crusaders' new leader, as after more than 10 months of delay, the Christians advance at almost breakneck speed. The thoughts of a fervid conquest in Lebanon and Palestine were abandoned. The Crusader army had marched onwards to Jerusalem, capturing several ports along the way. They arrived finally at their ultimate destination on the 7th of June 1099. Of the vast army that had left Europe, there were only now around 1,300 knights and some 12,500 infantry to achieve what was supposed to be the primary goal of the crusade. Almost 90% of those who set out from Western Europe did not make it to Jerusalem, either because of death or desertion. Those who made it, the site of the holy city of Jerusalem, was incredibly moving, because it was the most sacred Christian site on earth. It was the home of Jesus Christ and the place where he lived, learnt, taught, worked, been baptized, and where he was tortured to death by the hands of his own people, the Jews and the Romans. Protected by massive walls and a combination of moat and precipices, Jerusalem was going to be a tough military nut to crack. Fortunately, a number of Genoese ships arrived at just the right moment with timber, which was used to make two siege towers, catapults, and a battering ram. Despite these weapons, the defenders resisted the siege. Although the Muslim garrison was remarkably reluctant to break out and make raids on the besiegers, perhaps being content to sit and await from the promised relief coming from Egypt. Then, in mid-July, Godfrey of Bouillon decided to attack what he thought looked like a weaker section of the wall. Setting up their siege tower under the cover of darkness and filling a proportion of the moat, the Crusaders managed to get in touching distance of the walls. With Crusaders following and Godfrey leading from the front, the attackers scaled the defences and found themselves inside the city on the 15th of July, 1099 AD. One Crusader joyfully reported, "With the fall of Jerusalem, one could see many marvellous works. Some pagans were mercifully beheaded, others pierced by arrows pledged from towers, others tortured for a long time were burnt to death in searing flames. Piles of heads, hands and feet littered the streets. Even the soldiers carrying out the killing could hardly stand the stench rising from the blood flowing at their ankles. Jews as well as Muslims were also butchered. This was a holy war in all its horror. Many Muslims fled Jerusalem's most hallowed ground. Revered in Islam is the site of Muhammad's ascent to heaven. The Christian warriors went after them, cutting them down as far as the famous mosque where there was such a massacre that the Crusaders were wading through their enemies' blood." The massacre that took place on the streets of Jerusalem was not simply a feral outpouring of pinned-up rage. It was a coldly calculated campaign of killing that lasted at least 2 days. The holy city was covered in blood and decorated with corpses. In a moment that perfectly encapsulated the Crusaders' extraordinary fusion of violence and faith. At the sunset of July the 15th, 1099, the Crusaders, still painted in enemy blood, gathered together in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the site of Christ's death and the resurrection, to give thanks to their God. For us today, the idea that the first Crusaders could present themselves as faithful Christians even as they carried out acts of butchery might seem abhorrent, almost incomprehensible, in fact. But to understand the first Crusades, we must see the world as they saw to appreciate that they had a distinctly medieval conception of religion. All the best contemporary evidence suggests that they adamantly believed in what they were doing, that for them, killing for Christ was in itself an act of devotion, an expression of faith that would open the gates of heaven. The Christians truly believed the Urban's call to arms was indeed inspired by divinity, and that they had God's blessing to proceed for centuries to come. The Middle East was then locked in a gruesome battle that would rage for 200 years, a conflict in which Muslims would embrace the cause of jihad, uniting in pursuit of vengeance and the Holy Land's reconquest. The First Crusade was successful in that Jerusalem was recaptured, but to ensure the Holy City stayed in Christian hands, it was necessary that various Western settlements were established in the Levant, collectively known as the Crusader States, or Outremer, the Latin East. The four states were the County of Edessa, the Principality of Antioch, the Count of Tripoli, and the Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Kingdom of Jerusalem covered what is now Israel and Palestine, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the adjacent areas. The other northern states covered what are now Syria, southeastern Turkey, and Lebanon. Orders of knights were created. These were the Knights Templar, the Knights Hospitaller, for their better defence in bringing Holy Land Crusaders to the land that was being ruled by the Crusaders. Clearly, a steady supply of new Crusaders would be needed in the coming decades, and a wave of taxes to fund them. Initially, there were massacres of local populations, but the Westerners soon realised that to hold on to their gains, they needed the support of the diverse local populations of the Middle East. Consequently, there grew a tolerance of non-Christian religions, with some restrictions. Despite the continued recruitment drive in Europe and attempts to create permanent colonies and kingdoms, it proved impossible to hold on to the gains of the First Crusade, and more campaigns were required to recapture such cities as Edessa and Jerusalem itself after its fall again in 1187. There would be 8 official crusades and several other unofficial ones throughout the 12th and 13th centuries, which all met with more failure than successes. There were unforeseen or negative consequences to the First Crusade, notably the rupture in the Western-Byzantine relations and the Byzantines' horror at the unruly groups of warriors causing havoc in their territories. Outbreaks of fighting between Crusaders and Roman forces were common, and the mistrust and suspicion of their intentions grew. It was a troublesome relationship that only got worse, and the ill feeling and mutual distrust between the East and West would rumble on and culminate in the sacking of Constantinople in 1204 AD, the Eastern Roman Empire finally being brought to its knees. But that, my dear listeners, is a tale for another time and a story to be told in the future. Sorry again for another long episode today, but I won't lie, I am really enjoying telling this tale. Ever since I started the podcast, I really wanted this tale to be told in its fullest extent, but I also didn't want it to last 6 episodes, hence the length. So I hope you understand why I've crammed in so much information into one episode and why it's extremely long. But next week, we will finally do an episode on Scotland's participation in the First Crusade and any crusades going forward, understanding what role the nation of Scotland played in this European-wide theatre of war. Just a reminder, the Undertaking took place during the final years of Donald's reign and throughout Edgar's reign. After next week's episode, I will hopefully have the episode 2 rewrite done and ready to be re-recorded and released, so be on the lookout for that. Also, the next proper episode in this series will have us return to our Scottish tale and the reign of Alexander I of Scotland, so there is much to look forward to. Anyway, thank you again to everyone for the continued support on this series. Thank you to John, Nicola, Barry and Jonathan for your kind words that you've left in emails and on Facebook. And if you have the time, please do follow our Twitter at The History of SC1. And as I said, we also have a Facebook group called The History of Scotland if you wish to discuss the episodes with myself with feedback and comments head there. Thank you so much to all the comments I've had over the past couple of weeks. I've seen a lot more reviews on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, follows on Twitter, likes in the Facebook group, and nice comments sent to me on Facebook. It's been really great to see everyone being interested in medieval history, but more importantly, Scottish history. So enjoy the ride, and I hope you carry on enjoying the show. As always, any corrections or issues with this podcast, please also let me know at historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Please leave a review if you can, and our podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and many other great podcasting sites. Next podcast will be next week as normal, so until then, stay safe, have a great week guys, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace out and Deus vult.